Welcome to Forging Plowshares, a community dedicated to cultivating the peaceful kingdom of God. We hope this part of our ongoing conversation stimulates your mind and challenges your heart about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Please stay tuned at the end of the podcast for a short message about our ministry.
Is the guy's name Tim Alberta?
Yes, Tim Alberta, that's it. Oh, his father died and he went back to the church, you know, for the funeral. And I think it was, must have been right in the midst of the Trump, not 2016, but in his sermon or in his talk, you know, about his father, he brought something, you know, up about this. And of course, even before he came, the congregants knew. He had already written a book on Trump. And they just, people in the church, people that he had known his whole life, that literally had held him when he was a baby, you know, began to attack him at his own father's funeral, you know, saying, well, you're not a Christian, you're a traitor. So he spent the next several years trying to figure out. So he's written a book on his research. I don't know that he is particularly disposed to the peaceable kingdom, but I then got interested in him, curious about him. So I went and watched a couple of interviews of him, but he keeps bringing out the Sermon on the Mount and turning the other cheek. Which I don't think is part of Presbyterian doctrine, but
oh well, it's pretty standard now, the mainline Christianity. You'll find, I think, all the mainline denominations at this point have a predisposition towards pacifism, mostly in the clergy, not necessarily in the laity. But, you know, it's held like anything mainline Christians hold, sort of, isn't that polite? Isn't that the polite way we should treat each other? You know, it's not like radical or anything.
Well, I think the thing that stands out to him, and maybe the only thing that he notices, is that these people tend to focus on the Old Testament.
Okay.
And on Zionism, nationalism, and very little reference to the New Testament, and almost no reference to the Sermon on the Mount.
Gotcha.
Kind of, it's tied in a little bit. Well, not a little bit. I think it's very much tied in to the subject of their class. What is the relationship between culture and religion, religion and the nation state? He calls himself an evangelical, but he now wonders what that is.
Gotcha.
I thought our podcast, John, turned out really well. I don't know if you listened to it. I didn't edit much. I took out our, you know, obviously, except the part where you said your voice is bad because you've been smoking and drinking all week. That's too good to leave out.
Well, at least the smoking part was a lie.
I liked that too. I heard it. I appreciated that. That was good.
Good to hear from you, Brian. Everything good?
Glad to be able to join y'all, at least by audio.
Oh, good deal. And Simon is here.
Yeah. Hi, finally connected. This is the first Zoom call I've ever done on this computer, so I had some connection problems. There's actually two cameras on here, and it was automatically using the one that was pointing at the ceiling, but now my face is on the screen, so that's an improvement.
Good deal. Right. And you're in Finland.
Yes. It's 6 p.m. here. Thanks for getting up so early.
I actually enjoy doing morning as much, or maybe more than evening. Tim, good to see you.
Hey, am I working okay?
Well, I don't know about that, but I can see you.
I said to myself, I'm only staying in the class if you can answer one question for me, Paul.
Uh-oh.
What four teams are competing for the Super Bowl? But you can't answer that, can you? You got to get your priorities straight, my friend. I bet you can tell me who's leading the Republican nomination right now.
Well, I know that.
Oh, dear.
All right. And actually, David should know the teams because you played football for Arizona State.
We don't talk about the Scum Devils, but I did play at the University of Arizona. So I was a part of the Pac-10. In a couple months, the Pac-12 will cease to exist.
And David can answer your question too. What are the four teams playing? Contending for the Super Bowl? Is that it?
Yeah, Kansas City, Detroit, and then let's see what happened the day before. I was
Well, I'm glad to see you're hesitant.
The Ravens and the 49ers.
That's right. The Ravens and the 49ers. It's the AFC that throws me off because of my allegiance to the Colts.
Can you tell Simon about yourself?
I suppose I can. Simon, I live in the heartland of America. We are famous for a Ku Klux Klan governor, the Indianapolis 500, just little things like that. But I actually live in Terre Haute, Indiana. Yeah. So, yeah, I've known, been aware of Forging Plowshares, Paul Exton, probably since 2017, 2018. I was kind of going through some major shifts in my thinking. I wasn't jumping off Christianity, but I feel like maybe I was jumping into it, even though I'd been a Christian for 40 years. Anyways, I started reading stuff I really couldn't understand, but I caught something every once in a while gleaned something off of Paul's podcast and different things. And I thought, man, I need to look into this. I actually had a good friend, Paul, John Nugent up in Michigan, but he kind of turned me on to some different people like John Howard Yoder and Stanley Harawas and stuff like that. And then that became the death of who I was. So here I am.
I'm Jonathan Toddy. I'm in Naperville, Illinois, and I studied with Paul back when he was teaching at Central Christian College of the Bible in Moberly, and that's where we got to know each other and have been studying with him ever since.
What were you, about 18 when you started?
Yeah. I was 18.
He's not 18 anymore. And John is going to actually teach a class. He taught a class for us last year and is going to teach a class this year on the Synoptic Gospels. I already had an inquiry about the class, and they were wondering what book you were using.
We use several sources, but I think if we just had to get one book, maybe it would be this. It's by John Deere. It's called The Gospel of Peace, a commentary on Matthew, Mark, and Luke from the perspective of nonviolence. It's not bad. I really like this book, which is sort of a classic in this in reading the gospel this way, Binding the Strong Man, which is by Ched Myers, and it's got study books with it and things, but that's just the Gospel of Mark. So we'll probably use stuff out of it, but probably this is a new book.
Tim, can you explain your location and situation?
Yeah, am I explain my location? Yeah, I'm in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Your neighbors to the north, a lot of Americans don't know about Canada, but here we are. We have one team in the Major League Baseball, which is Toronto Blue Jays, and we have the Toronto Raptors. Both of them are back east, so that's part of the
Nobody
Canada
cares,
that we
have Tim.
But Paul, see, that's why I started with the sports question, the college ball. Of course, University of Washington is just a little south of us. So,
and Brian.
Yes. Hello, Simon. Nice to meet you. I am, and this is for you, Tim, my Carolina Panthers. I think probably still need a coach and aren't anywhere near the playoffs, but they're my local home team, and I don't keep up much with them. It's an accident that I know anything about the Panthers themselves. Yeah, I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina. This is now 2 years. I've been engaged with Forging Plowshares and these courses. Haven't missed one since this time 2 years ago. And I'm a hospice chaplain and have been for about 10 years. And yeah, just love these. The content of these classes seem to really be a tight weave with each other. And I've never had that, even in programs of study at fine institutions in college and divinity school. I've been real thankful to continue these classes and conversations. I was telling Paul the other day, has really enriched me, and I don't know where I would be if I didn't have these six intensives in all different subjects for the past 2 years. We're launching our 18-year-olds, our youngest, and we have a 21-year-old too, and a couple of others who are even older than that living in other states, but you know, entering into this phase of life, it's been real fun to be connected to y'all. Glad to have you too.
Thanks for your introductions, everyone. It's really nice to meet you. I've heard your voices on the podcast many times over the last few years, and now it's great to finally put faces to those voices. So great to meet you. I'm Simon, and as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm originally British, but I've been living in Finland, which is a bit further east, as you probably know. For 25 years now, I'm married to a Finn, and I have two teenage daughters. I started out in science. I did a degree in biochemistry and worked in that field for a while. So I've been very interested to read what Hart has to say about naturalism. But that was about 30 years ago when I did that degree. And about 15 years ago, I did another bachelor's and then master's degree with London School of Theology. And that was a chance for me to really dive deep into my faith. I became an active Christian during my first degree 30 years ago or so. And certainly ever since I studied for a master's, reading theological books and thinking theological things has been very much part of my life. And as part of that, I can't quite remember where or when I first came across Plowshares. It was probably through reading something by Brad Jerzak or Pete Enns or Michael Hardin. I've really lost the memory of where I first came across, but I put the website in my favorites. And on and off over the last 4 years or so, I've been an avid listener to the podcast and Paul's sermons and reading Paul's blog, and especially so in the last year or two. I've very much benefited from all of your discussions and particularly from your sermons and blog posts, Paul. So thank you very much for that. And I'm very excited now to be not just listening to just on my phone, on my own, but actually connected in. I'm very excited about being part of this group and the course to come. Thank you for including me.
Oh, we're excited to have you. I've been telling everybody, we have our first Finnish-British student. you've been listening to the edited version of me. So I hope it's
cut
not
all
just
bad language.
Yeah. It's when Tim's on, we got to, I got to continually edit the cussing. So let me begin today. The class is overly ambitious. I'll say that right up front. Religion and culture. Well, that's everything. how do we encompass that? But of course, what we're dealing with, and even talking about the term religion, I think that this is part of the thing that Wright brings out, is that even to talk about religion as an entity unto itself is a modern understanding. That if you go back, certainly in the first century, but even in Japan, or if you've lived in a traditional culture, I thought Alan might come this morning, and I'm suspicious that in Mexico, that it's a more traditional culture religiously than the United States. So we usually talk about the United States as a secular culture, and of course, what that means is a little bit up for debate. But part of what it means is not simply that it's irreligious, but that religion is in some ways shuttled to a kind of private sphere. I don't know how in Finland, I'm assuming that it would you call it a secular society?
Oh, absolutely. Very secular. Yes. So to bring up religion in a conversation is a taboo, really.
And of course, here we have a unique problem that you Canadians and British and everybody else is, and that is that we're in the midst of the rise of Donald Trump, right-wing republicanism, in which there is a fusion of religion. At least it's being brought out publicly, that I think was always there. And now I think it's being exposed in a way that it was there when I was a child. It was just that no one thought very much about it. Christian nationalism. So step one, and the thing I'd like to do today, is just problematize the term religion. This is my nephew's book. He teaches at Amherst University. And the title of his book is The Greatest Problem. David, you've got your hand in the air. I don't want you to get worn out.
I was joking around a little bit about the Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, but I picked up a book on the Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland here in Indiana. What is fascinating was in 1925, we elected a Klan governor. And Indiana wasn't, I mean, Illinois and even where I grew up out on the West Coast had a lot of Klan influence. But what is fascinating, and I'm only, you know, an hour or two into the book, is that the very stuff that we're facing, at least within the American culture, there's nothing new. The church was promoting Klan membership under the guise of, you know, we're going to correct the morals of our society and stuff like that. And I'm like, this is what we see in our culture today. We're just repeating. I was just going to throw that out there. I just find it super fascinating. So when you were talking about your childhood, I wonder if it's just been so embedded within our culture. You know, we don't even see it. It's the water we swim in. It's the air that we breathe. So if somebody shows us something different, like Jesus, we can't see it.
Yeah, this is the issue. That is that what is the difference between culture and religion? I'm facing this problem. Of course, I'm here in the middle of the heartland. I'm more in the heartland than you are in Missouri. The place that I live officially is called Little Dixie. I don't know if that resonates with you, Simon. The idea that Dixie was what the Confederacy was called. So these people here, though Missouri was not a southern state officially, unofficially, it's always sympathized with slavery, white supremacy. I just found out last week or so that even the little town where my church is at was what is called a sundown town. If you're black, at least in the past, this is no longer true, but you shouldn't be there past sundown. So the white supremacy, the racism is just integral to this culture. And it's very much integrated into the Christian nationalism. And of course, if you just confronted somebody and said, well, are you, most people, unlike in Illinois, may not overtly embrace racist attitudes, but they're there in the Christian nationalism. And of course, that's what's being promoted in Trumpism. Trump is nearly vocal on these issues. But I must say about this, about the little church I'm in, David, you may have a more enlightened congregation. They're not for Trump. But I think that where this leaves them is in total confusion. Well, you know, the United States was a Christian nation, which, of course, I hope you all understand that's a myth. There's no such thing as a Christian nation. This is the problem that we faced. In Japan, I think Japan is an interesting case in point. Why is religion a problem in Japan? Because several things hit Japan. So it's a kind of interesting modern experiment in which secularism enters into Japan, whatever we might mean by that. But part of what we mean by secularism is that the sphere of religion becomes extracted, or at least noticeable, from the sphere of the nation state and culture. They're trying to ward off the West through the nation state. And so religion is going to become a key topic, because one of the prime things they see as problematic is that Christianity is going to come in and in some way make people disloyal to the state. And what we mean by the state, of course, is inclusive of the state Shinto or of state religion. And of course, there's really not even the full formation of what is called state Shinto. In the Meiji Restoration is the time when that's forming. I'm saying all of this not to so much inform you about Japan, but to get so that you might get a sense of what it might have been like in the first century, and to be able to locate ourselves in what is called modernity. So I think until we get a feel for what a traditional society felt like, we really won't understand even the category religion and won't be able to locate ourselves, because, you know, I think we just tend to imagine at the beginning of this, oh, we all know what religion is and we know how, you know, that functions in relationship to culture. This is Inoue Kawashi in 1884. So remember, the Americans have come in to Tokyo Bay with the gunboats, Admiral Perry, and said, okay, Japan has to open up to trade to the United States and the Western powers. For 200 years, Japan has isolated itself from any foreign trade other than the Dutch in Nagasaki, and that was very isolated. And part of the reason they've isolated themselves is to ward off colonization by the West, and what they see as part of colonization is to convert the population. So even the term conversion is a kind of problematic term, because if you can convert, you know, your religion, if you can change your religion, doesn't that in some way endanger the population in its loyalty to the nation state? Because religion and the state had always, you know, from the time of Rome, but nearly everywhere, what we mean by the nation state or the city state had been tied in to the religion, such that in Greek there is no term religion. N.T. Wright, you know, notes this. And then in modern India, there was no word for religion. Wright points this out, that it's not until the British come and start calling that thing that the Indians do Hinduism and say, oh, this is their religion, that the Hindus discovered they even had a religion, or the Indians discovered they have a religion. The same thing is true in Japan. There is a word, religion, shukyo, but it's a neologism. It's a new word that's just been coined, you know, in the 1800s to capture this sense, oh, there's this special sphere apart. So people didn't think about their duties, their civic duties, their duties to the emperor, their identity as a Japanese person, and their religion as separate things, any more than a good Roman citizen would think about his sacrificing to the gods. In other words, the religious practices were simply part of being a good citizen. And suddenly that comes up for question in modern Japan. And by modern, I mean from the 1800s, because you have several things happening in Japan. You have the West threatening militarily and religiously, which may be the same thing in their understanding and in reality. You have the modern state is being formed in Japan, what is going to be called the Meiji Restoration. And of course, the restoration is the restoration of the emperor to the center of the state. And then within Japan, even the, you know, so-called religions that are practiced in Japan, there is tension. First of all, there's tension within Shintoism. Is Shintoism a religion, or is it a national identity? That's the issue. And various people within Shintoism they're going to argue for different sides of this. And of course, then Buddhism is also problematic. And Buddhism is going to be separated out where it had not been separated out previously. Even when I was there, there's a shrine in Tokyo. A shrine is Shinto, and it's right next to a temple. And this is often the case in Japan, that temples and shrines are adjacent to one another. And I had never seen it. Actually, it was after I'd moved back to the States and I'd taken some students over, and they were taking the gods out of the Shinto shrine. There were three gods, and they carried them over to the Buddhist temple to spend the night. In other words, they don't differentiate between, people did not traditionally differentiate between Buddhism and Shintoism. Most people, the common people. But of course, if you're a Buddhist priest or you're a Shinto priest, you may, in fact, want to distinguish. And when this all becomes part of official government policy, which is going to happen in the Meiji Restoration, you know, what happens if Shintoism is declared not a religion, but just state ideology? Well, then, of course, Shinto priests are going to be functionaries of the state, and Buddhist priests are going to be religious. So this is the debate that's taking place, and the debate is about Shukyo. What is religion and what isn't religion? And it's actually quite politically fraught, because how you decide this issue is going to determine the role. And of course, in all of this, I haven't mentioned Christianity. The thing that everybody wants in the national government is to ward off Christianity. They see Christianity as a threat, and they see conversion as a threat, because conversion, you know, historically in Japan, that there was the Christian century in Japan, in which hundreds of thousands of people became Christians and entire clans became Christian. And I'm putting that in quotes, because what you find among these clans is they begin to look very similar to the knights in the West, that they put crosses on their shields and they would begin to fight in the name of Christ, so that they replaced their local gods. They became Christian, but not necessarily nonviolent. In fact, Christianity had threatened a centralized government or a centralized identity in Japan previously. But you understand, that's always the threat to conversion, with the idea of conversion. Unless, you know, why, when we talk about a secular society, I imagine in Finland and England, I'm not sure about Canada. What is your percentage of church attendance, Tim, in Canada?
I want to say maybe 20 to 30%, but that might be a bit high now. And you know the story of Quebec. Quebec, like prior to 1970, was like 88% or something, and then sort of this revolution. Now it's considered the greatest decrease of religious affiliation in the history of the world. You know, it's now less than 4% or something. It's become the most, you know, and Quebec up until 40 years ago didn't technically belong to Canada. It reported directly to the Vatican. There's, you know, I don't know the whole history, but there's some kind of a real connection there. But yeah, it's secularization is pretty much the same thing here, but maybe 20% is even too high, but I'm just guessing. Yeah.
Have any of you read recent statistics in the United States as to church attendance? I know it's rapidly decreasing, and because of the drama that we're going through right now, I think for most of my life that the United States was like, you know, more than 50% and maybe up to 70%, and I'm sure that right now it's below that. But there is still, the United States is kind of an odd place in terms of religious sensibility. And even though the secularism is playing out here, it's playing out with a slightly different note than in Finland or in, you know, I'm guessing, and or in, I've spent time in Great Britain, and I kind of got the feel there for what it secular means.
Something that I have read within recent several articles, that it's interesting, even though church attendance is falling, even though churches are closing, there is a whole group out there, they would identify themselves as evangelical Christian, even though that's not necessarily the group that says, you know, the church is a mess. That's the group that identifies with that kind of our political far right. And there's evidence of people, you know, my sister, she would consider herself an evangelical Christian. She doesn't go to church, but she stands with that far right crowd. And that's an interesting phenomenon.
I mean, I've heard this is secondhand information, but there's a Pew, I think it's a Pew survey that points out that there are now Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Sikh, it does not matter, who identify as evangelical because they understand that label to have a sort of national, you know, we would say Christian nationalism, but it is that wedding together of nationalism, right-wing politics, and religion.
So evangelical now means right-wing Republican for many people, I guess, which, yeah, makes the term suspect. So when we're talking about religion, what we often think of is the Protestant sensibility of a private faith and maybe even a Reformation notion or Lutheran notion of faith is something that you do mentally in your head. So what we have is a separation between religion, faith, and practice, so that we can talk about a secular space, which doesn't necessarily mean, you know, this is Charles Taylor's point, that capitalism and the rise of the nation state is all very much connected to this sensibility of a separating out of the sphere of religion, which in traditional societies, there first of all, there was no religion per se, and there was no notion of a organized state apart, you know, that to even think about the two separately, it didn't happen. So that, you know, think back to Socrates. This is Wright's point in that article. The last thing he does, his last words are, well, we need to sacrifice a cock to the god of healing. And why, you know, what Socrates might have meant by that, we really don't know. Whether he meant, oh, now I'm going to shed my body and I'm finally healed of material reality, or whether he thought of it as that in some way his own death was, in a Girardian sense, you know, he was playing a kind of sacrificial role. But the point is that here was maybe one of the premier thinkers who, you know, Plato and Aristotle, and that they're really identifying in the same way that Socrates did. They're not departing from the notion of the gods, because to be a Greek, to be patriotic, to be loyal, you practice the religion. That's the case, you know, obviously in the case of Christianity, is if it didn't interfere with practices, I don't think Christianity would be a threat. And of course, with the separation of faith and practice, there is the sense that that Protestant notion of Christianity actually makes room for a division between those two things, so that, you know, you can be a good Christian and a right-wing Republican and support someone like Donald Trump, just using this as an illustration, because the two spheres, you know, are separate. The kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of earth, those are two different places. Let me read this. The matter of religion, this is Inoue Kawashi. The matter of religion is indeed the single greatest problem confronting political policy. And if not properly addressed, it may produce unforeseeable problems in the future and lead to insurmountable complications. In light of the experience of nations through the ages, this appears a matter not to be taken lightly. I had a little school in Tokyo, and Trent came and stayed at the school and was going to the diet and tracing this debate in the diet records. So he's running down, oh, this was the argument in the 1800s, 1860 to the turn of the century. What are we going to do with the religion? Where it lands, and I don't know if you all are familiar enough with state Shinto, is that Shintoism is not a religion, right? And thus, everybody must bow to the emperor. And by bowing to the emperor, in the pre-war period, this was obviously a sign not simply of, oh, respect. This was an act of worship. And so every church, other than those who would refuse, had a picture of the emperor. And before you begin a worship service, you bow to the emperor first. So it's non-religious, meaning that the state is going to encompass religion. But actually, that arrangement is the normal arrangement. That is, that the larger category here is identity as a Japanese person. But let me suggest that before this clash came about, this was actually the way people normally thought, that you do the religion just because that's what you do. That's part of being Japanese. Even to this day, you know, if you go to a shrine or you raise the question with somebody, are you religious? Most Japanese would say no. But understand that 70% to 80% pay homage at a shrine, and the same numbers have a butsudan, that is a private Buddhist altar or a private shrine in their home. So either the Japanese are the most irreligious people in the world or the most religious. That is, I just gave you a statistic, you know, 70% to 80% actually practice Shintoism and Buddhism. There's more religion than there are people. So most people are doing both religions. And if you ask them, though, are you religious? They'll say, no, I'm not religious. And of course, what they mean is the religion, what you're using a term that is still an ambiguous term, shukyo. They made up a word. But even to say that, you know, that Trent goes through in the book and talks about, before they even had a word, they were trying to come up with a way to describe this. And they began to use terms that would talk about either within Buddhism, practices within Buddhism, or practices that are talking about a kind of institution. And so being Japanese is a larger category than religion. But isn't that true in Rome? You know, if you would ask a Roman citizen, do you observe the festivals? Do you sacrifice at the temple? Well, of course I do. I'm a Roman citizen. Do you believe? And I think that question is a peculiarly modern question, a peculiarly Protestant question, maybe, because the issue is not one of belief. You know, do you believe the religion? Well, no, I don't. What do you mean, do I believe the religion? Do I have to believe it? I don't think it occurs to most Japanese, and I'm guessing it. You know, maybe in Rome, if you were an educated Roman, they'd say, no, I don't buy it. But of course, what we're describing is already a contradiction. Can you practice something that you don't believe? We're trying to separate out faith and practice because that's natural to us. But belief is not, it's simply not an emphasized thing. What my claim here about Japan is, this is not abnormal, this is normal throughout human history. That there is an ambiguity between religion and culture. Maybe in this, in our context, David, if you go to one of your national religious festivals called American football, and at the beginning of that religious festival, I think everybody gets up and worships the idol and sings a song to the idol. And if you would tap somebody during the singing of that national religious song, the national anthem, and say, are you religious? They wouldn't understand your question. And I'm being slightly facetious, but not really. In other words, I think that nationalism plays the same role as religion plays. It's just that now we understand I can do that, you know, that other stuff, and we need not impinge upon people's private beliefs. But publicly, if you go to the Chiefs game and you refuse to stand during the singing of the national anthem, you may face some trouble. In other words, if you ask somebody, are you religious? You know, whatever their answer is. You know, the other thing, if they pledge allegiance, actually there is part of the pledge is under God.
I've thought about this in a different way, very much in agreement with what you're saying. but another angle. And I'm trying to remember who I heard this from. He was speaking rather he didn't think he was speaking disparagingly about the Church of England, but he was. And this is true probably of a lot of mainline Christianity or patriotism in the United States. It's not, I think one way of looking at it is we're very quick, and maybe this is sort of a Protestant thing, oh, you're worshiping some idol. It's the people worshiping themselves. And that was the quip, was the Church of England has mostly existed for the British people to worship themselves, and which is why everything hangs together so well. And you could say the same thing about the United States. I think that's what is perhaps odd in the U.S. is that we have that Puritan strain where everything becomes sort of moralistic. So you have this phenomenon with evangelicalism. It's much more zealous than that in some way with the Trump phenomenon. But I think in like the Episcopal Church or a lot of the mainline denominations here for most of our history, that's what it's been about, is a group of people gathering. Do you really believe it? Are you religious? Oh, no, you know, don't take any of this too seriously. But it's a corporate practice that does draw you together and provides for that cohesiveness. Of course, the danger is that, as you said, you know, like the football game or whatever it is, that it's usually intertwined with militarism, state violence, oppression of some people, who's out and who's in. But even there, thinking about what we've been reading, just the first 10 pages of Hart, but the whole book here, or Hart's project maybe is what I'm thinking about more. He gets into a lot of this, oddly, in Roland and Moonlight. He's talking a lot about his views on syncretism or perennialism. Maybe we ask if you could get rid of the militarism and the violence, is that all that bad of a thing that you would not be able to distinguish between self-reflectively religion, culture, what am I doing, am I religious? In other words, isn't the kingdom of God picturing a sort of reality where, no, you can't ask those questions with any sort of intelligibility. You simply are the human person fully alive in Jesus Christ.
That's good. In other words, I'm problematizing this, but I think we're counted into the problem, as you point out, that the problem of separating out culture and religion is part of the issue of the church, state church, Church of England, or many of the mainline. You know, Protestantism really didn't do anything about Constantinian.
All churches are state churches until recently.
Yeah.
Actually, it's funny. Just a small little anecdotal story. Growing up in the Anabaptist tradition, of course, very much a separation of church and state. Simon, I lived in Britain for 6 years and worked with the Church of Scotland. And I remember on what we have here as Remembrance Day or whatever, they had a remembrance for the soldiers. And here the local Church of Scotland minister would go down to the cenotaph, would lead the whole assembly about remembering soldiers. And I was like appalled, like, are you kidding me? Because, of course, my nonviolence background. The church is actually involved in, you know, in this particular ritual. And it was very much a, you know, again, even though Britain, I mean, it was very much the state was married to the church. And this is back in the early 2000s. So, I mean, it's endemic everywhere. We just, you know, try to pretend it's not. And we don't have flags in our churches, though. And actually, just a little comment there earlier. I was going to say, before you start, do some churches, before they start the service, pledge allegiance to the flag? I mean, does that ever happen? You know, it's sort of a, I don't know, I'm wondering.
That we don't do that, but actually I know that in some church functions, David, you may know better. I know that Tom, one of the particular things, the particular group they were a part of, they were required to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag in the church.
I, you know, just to keep making this point over and over again, I guess, and actually, Tim, you just sparked the thought. This is an interesting, talking about religion as a practice versus a belief and how all of these things are ingrained. It dawned on the Soviet Union at some point that it was not enough to simply let religion die out, which is what traditional Marxist doctrine says. That wasn't working, wasn't happening fast enough. They actually had to call upon the church to help them drum up enough patriotic fervor to beat the Nazis in World War II. They began to think, how then do you get people to stop having weddings, baptisms, and funerals, which were the three things that they saw as mostly problematic because it bookends your life and these people who are supposed to be good Soviet Marxist citizens wouldn't stop doing these things. And so the state comes up with its own liturgists and Marxist liturgists. And in Russia and several other places, not everywhere, but behind the Iron Curtain, they developed these services that would mark those same stages of life with a liturgy that was, basically what we're talking about, but totally unshorn of any vestige of, oh, you might be praying to transcendent God or whatever. No, it's just the state. And this is being a good citizen, being willing to kill and die for the state, etc. They weren't very popular at first. The only way that they eventually became popular was to tie together the dead of the Great Patriotic War, World War II, for the Soviets, and these events. So that even during a wedding, and I think they were called wedding palaces or whatever, there would be a flame that was brought from the cemetery commemorating the war dead to the wedding palace and lit in a ceremony to begin the wedding. And that link provided enough, you say, ideology, mysticism, whatever you want to call it, that finally made some of these services more popular. And the trouble is, of course, that how do you, I think something, a good religion, I don't mean good as in like, I mean, religion that works, not in a good sense, maybe not in a morally good sense anyway. It has to feel like you didn't make it up yesterday, right? This is the whole thing about idolatry, Paul, that's in Isaiah or the Psalms that you quote quite a bit. But as also Marx talks about this too, right? He calls it either fetishization or reification. But there has to be some sort of forgetting. Where did this come from? And I think the religion that we've inherited, or maybe patriotism, is more potent for us today than religion feels for many people, because we've lost that sort of inherited, et cetera, whatever, with Christianity. Why does this happen so well? Well, the American myth, we've completely gone through that cycle, or whatever nationalist myth you're living in. It seems to have lasted and be working very well.
I think this is the value in what Berger is describing. I want to say both things. I want to say what Eliade is saying, and I want to say what Berger is saying. And of course, they're both right and wrong in the same way that I think, this is what Bulgakov talks about, Plato and Aristotle both being right and wrong. And that is, but in Peter Berger, one of the things, I'm saying this in response to you, John, that one of the things that happens in religion with the sacred canopy, and that I talk about with the idol, and I think we could do René Girard in the same way, is that part of the function of religion is obscuring the fact that we made whatever it is that constitutes the religion. So, the case of the idol maker in Isaiah, he cooks his lunch and then turns back and worships the idol that he has fashioned. In Berger's three steps, there is the creation of the idol, the externalization, and then there is the reification. But in the process of reification, you have to obscure the origins. You have to, in some way, create a myth. Girard talks about the same thing in the scapegoating mechanism, that, well, we killed the guy, we murdered him, but what gets covered over in the myth, by the myth, is that fact, that we're the ones that committed the murder, that we did the sacrifice. And I think this is part of what, John, you mentioned in the mythologizing of the nation state that I think we're very much going through now. And I don't know how to unconvince people. I mean, facts don't seem to do it, to just say, well, that's not who the founders of this country were. You can quote them. But in people's minds, America was a Christian nation from its founding. And the, you know, the founders were all, you know, good Christian people. So there is an obscuring, a mythologizing that plays into ideology that makes the ideology functionable. So you don't see, you know, in the case of the Wizard of Oz, you don't see the little man from Kansas behind the curtain pulling all the strings. That's certainly true in the case of state Shinto in Japan. This conversation that we're having right now is almost unheard of, except among academics in Japan. Most Japanese, if they are probably even less aware than most people in the United States of the manufacturing of the mythology of Japaneseness. But this is the interesting thing, that because it's so recent in Japan, in the Meiji Restoration, and this is what Trent does in his book, you can just go back and look at the meetings in which they literally say, well, we need to have an ideology that people will follow, and they create state Shinto. The modern sense of Japaneseness, I think, is still largely simply an outpouring, the continuation of that understanding. The same thing has happened in this country. It's been a more gradual thing. I don't know if it's as overt, but of course, that's what we're seeing, is the nationalism that was actually the religion has now just kind of, it's separating out and becoming the primary content. The point is that in all of this, the thing that is called religion, it permeated everybody's life to such a degree. The God, you know, this is even true today in Japan. There are gods that reign over. There's the kitchen gods. There's the toilet gods. There's the forest gods. So that the gods or the deities are in control of every area of life. Kind of, there's two voices here coming through as I'm thinking about Hart and the thing that he's doing is saying, well, it's certainly true that God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. But of course, in a kind of secularized society, in a kind of demythologization, we've kind of extracted that out. And maybe we've created an alternative reality, you know, in the process, imagining that there is such a thing as a space separate from God. I don't think there actually is, but certainly the mythologization is not true either. So the notion of religion as a realm apart is really kind of a modern understanding. And so that's the sensibility that, you know, you get with the rise of Christianity in Rome or Christianity in Japan. You know, that was the thing that the shogun worried about. If somebody says that Jesus is Lord, well, wait a minute, I thought the shogun was Lord, or I thought the emperor was Lord, because quite literally the emperor to this day is still God. And so the notion of personal belief or private faith were allowed for even in Rome. Nobody really cared. You know, there were such a thing as a cultus privatus, a private cult. You can do whatever you want in your head. You can do whatever you want privately, just as long as it doesn't interfere with practicing the state religion. But isn't that the place where we found ourselves now? Oh, you can do that thing that you do privately, but you have to in some way conform to the public square.
Forging Plowshares is a community dedicated to cultivating the peaceful kingdom by providing in-depth, transformative biblical and theological education and discipleship. If you have found this podcast valuable, please remember to share on social media. If you have questions about what you've heard, or if you'd like to learn more about how you can get involved with Forging Plowshares, or even support this ministry financially, please visit our website, forgingplowshares.org.